What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's da bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things anti-nuclear. My name is Libby Halevi. I'm the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when the nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, we learn about the thyroid issues faced by Fukushima's children from two different sources. First, we talk with documentary filmmaker Ian Thomas Ashe about his feature-length film, A2BC, about how he came to film the mothers and children of Fukushima as they struggled with radiation and health issues only 18 months after the nuclear disaster began. Then, in another of our Voices from Japan series, Beverly Findlay Kaneko speaks the words of her husband, Yuji Kaneko, on what he has seen and learned during his recent visits to Fukushima. These two pieces combine to create a compelling picture of a people who are struggling against the consequences of the ongoing nuclear disaster. Plus, you'll get to hear our listener favorite, Numbnuts of the Week, as well as activist shoutouts, the Jon Stewart Twitter campaign, and more nuclear information than you'll hear this week on all broadcast and cable television stations combined. This will be coming up in just a few moments. Today is Tuesday, November 18, 2014, and here is the week's anti-nuclear news. First, a correction from last week's show. In the special report by Sean McKee, a.k.a. Arclight, he said, "Recent findings and admissions by the UK government that depleted uranium has caused similar genomic problems in Iraq veterans" was a bit of an overstatement. In fact, only two soldiers from the first Iraq war were partly compensated for depleted uranium health effects to themselves whilst cleaning out affected tanks. 2,000 others were awarded health pensions due to war damage. We regret the errors. At the waste isolation pilot plant near Carlsbad, New Mexico, the restart of a fan in the exhaust system has spread more radioactivity into the environment. What's been labeled a small amount of americium-241 was detected a few hundred feet from one of the monitoring stations on site. There is a major investigative piece in the Santa Fe, New Mexican by reporter Patrick Malone that we will link to on the website. In addition, we will be speaking on next week's show with Don Hancock of Southwest Research and Information Center about all the latest doings at WIP. By the way, Don predicted this radiation leak on Nuclear Hot Seat number 174 on October 21st. America's other current serious nuclear accident, the one that happened at the Honeywell Uranium Conversion Facility in Metropolis, Illinois, has been upgraded from plant emergency to alert, the second of four accident categories from the NRC that starts with unusual event and ends with the equivalent at number four of kiss your posterior goodbye. On October 26th, Honeywell reported a leak of uranium hexafluoride, claiming the leak was contained within the building, later admitting that the leak was not contained within the building and was released into the environment, while still claiming it did not go off-site of the facility. Of course, it stopped at the fence. Not so according to a union worker who was on strike outside the facility and filmed the plume coming out of the top of the building and drifting across the property before water suppression systems were activated. According to Dave Kraft, director of the Chicago-based Nuclear Energy Information Service, or NEIS, the staggering number of mistakes, inaccuracies, change stories, and inadequate responses on the part of both Honeywell and the NRC beg for an independent investigation into Honeywell's ability to run so sensitive a facility and the NRC's ability to adequately regulate it. Kraft went on to say, NRC's existing regulatory scheme does not seem capable of protecting the public health and safety in a timely and responsible manner. Hear, hear. And speaking of the NRC, it is rewriting its radiation regulations using documents that are not open to the public. Industry, however, has access to these documents. WTF. Time to email, write, and call the NRC, demanding that documents be turned over and that the comment deadline be extended, so we can all give them a piece of our minds. And the NRC's outgoing chair, Allison McFarlane, told the National Press Club in D.C. that the NRC's rules are not geared for supervising the decommissioning of nuclear reactors, but rather, about 15 years ago, set itself up to oversee more reactor construction. Professor McFarlane, who leaves the wonderland of the NRC back to academia at the end of this year, said that the future of a proposed nuclear waste repository at Yucca Mountain near Las Vegas was still far from assured, despite the coming changes of party control in the Senate. And she offered another piece of advice for the next chairman. Get rid of the acronyms. Ba-bam! And the Pacific starfish die-off is now being blamed on a virus, formerly benign, but somehow it mutated. And while half the scientists and articles cited mention the M-word, mutation, none of them managed to put it together with the F-word, Fukushima. Speaking of which, last week, Arne Gundersen spoke about the radiation spike at Fukushima following the rains that came from the two typhoons in October. Now we're seeing that the radiation readings that were so outrageously high last week have risen yet again, and are up as much as 40,000% in 10 days. These were readings from the wells next to Unit 1 and 2, and included readings for radioactive cesium-134, 137, and manganese-54. As if that's not bad enough, Japan has chosen to incinerate tons of radioactive waste. It doesn't destroy the radiation, it just recycles it and redistributes it as smoke and ash. We'll have more on that during the Voices from Japan segment of our interviews today. At the Fukushima Daiichi site, a barrier designed to prevent radioactive water from entering underground tunnels is likely not doing its job. Ya think? On November 17, TEPCO drained 200,000 liters of water out of the Unit 2 trench after they declared that the end near the turbine building needed to be sealed. But after the water level only went down a fraction of the level they assumed it should have, they declared that the water must be coming from somewhere else, where they didn't seem to know, and they decided on a plan to fill the tunnels with cement before they are completely drained. We'll see how that one goes. But that's not crazy or incompetent enough, because...
Nuclear hot seat, nuclear hot seat, nuclear hot seat.
Oh, those wild and wacky Japanese nuclear safety, put that last word in quotes, experts. Put that one in quotes, too. In Niigata, which is 188 kilometers or 117 miles from Fukushima, the first nuclear disaster drill in 2013 was a bomb. You should pardon the expression. It involved a large number of volunteers who evacuated the area near the plant by bus. This took the evacuees not to safety, but right into the path of the simulated radiation plume. So what did the nuclear safety experts do? In 2014, they skipped having an evacuation drill and declared the radiation release would be too low for a drill. But they weren't out of the woods because they still had to administer protective iodine tablets to the public. TEPCO announced when they assumed radiation would begin leaking, and the governor ordered protective iodine to be administered to the public. But the central government insisted that iodine only be given out after a leak had already left the plant, and only to people in the plume path. Of course, the previous year's drill showed how unpredictable the plume path can be as the simulated plume changed directions when the weather shifted wind direction. The end result? The drill finished without the two government entities ever coming to an agreement on iodine distribution. And this is the exact same problem that happened during the Fukushima disaster, when there was confusion and conflicting demands, leading to most people never getting protective iodine. Get a grip! Safety in a nuclear accident is not subject to a turf war. Stick potassium iodine pills onto the glass badges and make it a twofer. Just another example of how, quote-unquote, nuclear safety is a contradiction in terms. And that's why these so-called experts are this week's
Nuclear Hot Seat, Num Nuts of the Week.
There is an achingly powerful poem that has been posted on evacuatefukushima.com. It's from a woman who posts only on Twitter under the name Satsukensuke, and we'll have a link to the poem up on our website. And a South Korean court, for the first time, has ruled in favor of a plaintiff claiming a link between radiation from a nuclear power plant and cancer, a verdict that could trigger similar lawsuits in a country that depends heavily on nuclear power. Can you imagine what a ruling like that would do here in the good old U.S. of A? Make the nuke industry nuts. And finally, there is an achingly powerful poem that has been posted on evacuatefukushima.com. It's from a woman who posts only on Twitter under the name Satsukensuke, and we'll have a link to the poem up on our website. We'll have our featured interviews in just a moment, but first, if you'd like a good read to curl up in bed with on a cold, snowy winter night, I suggest Yes, I Glow in the Dark, 1 mile from Three Mile Island to Fukushima and beyond. Admittedly, I'm prejudiced, because I wrote it. But I happen to think it's pretty good, and so have the people who have left 5-star reviews on Amazon. It is available as an Amazon Kindle. Hopefully by next year it's going to be in a book as well. But for now, you can read it electronically on any of your devices. Available at Amazon Kindle, just write Yes, I Glow in the Dark in the search box, and it will pop up. Once you read it, feel free to leave a 5-star review of your own. As we move into the interviews on this week's show, I want to share a news story that has direct relevance to what you're going to be hearing. We've learned that Fukushima children who have already been diagnosed with thyroid cancers are now finding that cancer is spreading to their lymph nodes and lungs. This is even if their thyroids have already been surgically removed. The numbers of cancer cases are climbing high enough that doctors and researchers across Japan are starting to question current data provided by the Fukushima Medical University. 370,000 children under the age of 18 at the time of the nuclear accident are subject to thyroid examination, and so far, 50 have been confirmed to have cancer and 39 are suspect. To put this in context, the last time that there were suspected cases of thyroid cancer, 98% of them turned out to be cancer. The total number of children whose initial examination results are confirmed is 287,056, and of that, 136,804, or 47.7%, showed nodules of 5 millimeters or smaller, or cysts of 20 millimeters or smaller. This diagnosis is known as A2. My first guest on this show is Ian Thomas Ash, a filmmaker living in Japan who has turned his camera on Fukushima's people since the first days after the March 11, 2011 earthquake, tsunami, and the start of the ongoing Fukushima Daiichi nuclear disaster. His full-length documentary on the mothers and children of Fukushima is entitled A2BC. Ian, welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thank you so much for having me.
Let's start out with a snapshot of your background. How did you become a documentary filmmaker?
I was born in New York, and I went to school in Plattsburgh, New York, and studied literature. And then I moved to Japan, and that was the first job that I got after graduation, and I was teaching English. And then I was writing stories and plays and poetry and things. I mean, I don't know if I decided to become a filmmaker or if I just, it was a natural progression. And I went to film school in the UK after having lived in Japan for 3 years. And then when I graduated from film school, I moved back to Japan because I really felt like Japan was my home.
At that point, did you speak Japanese? And the writing and the creative projects that you earlier did, the plays and the writing, was that in Japanese or in English?
It was in English. When I moved to Japan, I couldn't even say hello. And I moved to a place in the countryside where really English was not spoken by so many people. And so it was really a kind of baptism by fire. I just really had to learn Japanese very quickly. And I did. By the time I went to film school, I was speaking Japanese and really felt, more than falling in love with Japan, I actually felt like I'd come home.
Where were you on March 11 of 2011?
I was at my friend's house, just spending the day there. I was in Tokyo. I was about an hour away from where I lived, and the earthquake just happened. And it's interesting because it isn't until somebody asks me, like in this interview, and I try to piece together what is it that I knew or what is it that I was aware of at that time, and what is it that are things that I'm remembering that I really actually probably only knew later.
At that time, were you aware? Was there alarm? Was there any sense that something larger than just a major earthquake had happened?
No. At first, we thought that it was a big earthquake and that it was only that big and that it had only happened in Tokyo. There was glass that was broken in my friend's house. Everything out of the refrigerator had come, onto the floor. So we got really busy just sort of cleaning up her house. It wasn't until several hours later that we turned the TV on and realized that it was something that was much, much bigger than what had happened just in Tokyo.
How did you become aware of the problem at Fukushima Daiichi?
My dad called me from America and said, I'm not really sure what's going on, but this is what we're hearing. He's actually a priest, but before he went to seminary, he was working in nuclear power plants. And so he had a background, some kind of reference that he was coming from. I mean, he probably only knew what was being told online, but he was doing a lot of reading, a lot of researching. And, I don't think he certainly didn't have any inside information. But yeah, I think his sense, as a person with some kind of history in that industry, and then also probably as a father, was just sort of saying, gosh, this is something that you really need to think about.
When did you get the idea to shoot a film about Fukushima? And how did you get started with it?
For like 2 days, I was just sort of thinking, I was listening to the news reports on the radio and looking online and watching footage. And I was kind of almost frozen or just sort of didn't really know what to do. And my brother called me and said, Ian, you're a filmmaker, go out and film. And it took somebody telling me to do something that I always had been doing to actually get up and do it.
It's so easy to hit overwhelm under those circumstances and need that outside boost. So I'm not surprised that that was the dynamic. How did you become involved with the mothers and the children of Fukushima? Did you know some of them there? Or was this a situation where you just walked around with your camera and accosted people until you found the ones who would talk to you?
Well, in the beginning, for the first couple of days, I made some documentaries, short documentaries in Tokyo. I was working on stories about panic buying, about foreign people fleeing from Tokyo. And I actually did a short documentary every day for the first week. And then a friend of mine told me about some missionaries that were getting supplies from the American bases that are here in Tokyo. And they were getting donations of toilet paper and different things and bringing them up to Tohoku. And so I called them up and asked them if I could take a ride up with them. Because at that point, the highway was closed. You had to have a special permit in order to get on the highway to go up there. And we actually were going to Ishinomaki, which is an area that was devastated by the tsunami, but it's north of Fukushima. And when we were on the highway passing through Fukushima, one of the missionaries said, Fukushima's over there. I just had a sense. I just knew this is where I'm coming next. And so that was 10 days after the nuclear meltdown. Within 2 more weeks, I was in Fukushima filming.
What was the nature of that early footage that you took?
At that point in time, Many, many people were willing to talk. They wanted to talk, oversimplifying the issue, but it seems like they were more unified. People were just scared. They were looking out for their children. They were worried about the future, and they were kind of unified and certainly willing to speak. What I was concentrating on was children that were living in the zone 20 to 30 kilometers from the nuclear power plant in an area that was deemed so dangerous they had to remain indoors, and yet they had not been evacuated.
How were you received by the families that you approached to take footage?
There were not that many media people. Of course, I mean, we were not the only ones that were there. There were other media people there, but there were not a lot of foreign crews there. And there were not a lot of foreign crews that were staying in that area. A lot of people were staying, 40, 50, 60 kilometers outside of that area and then going in during the day filming and then going back out. We decided to stay inside to be able to see how people were actually living. And within 2 days, we were invited to stay with a family that has 4 children. And we actually lived with them for 2 weeks while we were filming the film and could see right, in their homes how they were living their lives.
What is the time frame covered by the footage in the film? Because from what you're saying, it sounds like it was within weeks or months of when the earthquake and tsunami and the nuclear disaster began.
The first film that I made, called In the Gray Zone, was filmed literally 1 month after the nuclear meltdown. And it was dealing with this issue of the kids that were living in this zone that was under orders to remain indoors. And then I continuously went back. So I made that film. 2012 is when it was released. And I kept going back to Fukushima every month. I was filming updates for my YouTube channel, doing other short documentaries in the area. And then 18 months later, when I met these mothers who were talking about the kind of thyroid cysts and nodules and other problems that their children were experiencing, I thought, wow, this is not just an update for the YouTube channel. This is another film. And that's when I made the film called A2BC, which is really, that's the work that people know of mine the most, but it's actually my second feature documentary that I filmed in Fukushima.
As you were shooting A2BC, which I was privileged to see last Sunday in a screening in California and was astonishingly powerful, as you were shooting, what kind of response were you getting from the people who you were filming and those around them?
It's so interesting, but it's also so scary that 18 months later, I found it much more difficult to find people who are willing to talk and people who are willing to talk on record.
Why do you think that was?
There was and there continues to be pressure on people to not speak out. Japan is a country where the expression that everybody uses is the nail that sticks up gets hammered down. And people are afraid to speak out and to be different.
Did you see any discernible impact by the fact that you were filming? Were you getting interference? Were you getting more people coming forward? Was there a sense of relief or anxiety on the part of the individuals who you were actually filming?
This is a really interesting question, and I think it's an extremely important question. The filming process, I think, it needs to be good for the people who are being filmed. And as a filmmaker, we must not exploit people for the good of the project, for example. And so, yes, that having their stories being listened to and having their stories treated with respect, I do hope, certainly, that it was a good experience for these mothers, even if it was only short-lived, even if at the end of the filming, on some level, I hope that it was some kind of relief for them. They also were able to introduce me to other mothers who wanted to speak. And so when I found the first few families that were willing to speak, they were able to introduce me to people in their circle that wanted to speak. So it kind of grew from there.
The title A2BC is a bit cryptic to those who haven't already seen the film. Explain what the title means.
A2BC are classifications of thyroid cysts and nodules. I want to make it clear that I'm a filmmaker and not a doctor, and so I'm going to explain it in an overly simplified filmmaker's point of view. A2 are thyroid cysts. It's one or more thyroid cysts or nodules that are less than 20 millimeters in size. And so A2 is something, it's a very, very wide category. There's no distinction between having one thyroid cyst and having 20 thyroid cysts. No distinction between having them spread out over the thyroid versus being all clumped together. And medically, we know that there is a very big difference between those two things, but the classification that the government is using is makes no distinction. And there's certainly a difference between having a thyroid nodule that is 1 millimeter versus 19.9 millimeters. So A2 is kind of the biggest category. And then B would be, they really need a second examination, really a follow-up examination quite quickly. And C would be asking for a biopsy right now.
The content of the film I found tremendously moving because you took almost a Frederick Wiseman approach, if I may parallel you with that documentarian, in that you didn't intrude on the narrative. The only time you were present was if you engaged in a little bit of conversation with the people who were there in the process of getting the footage. How intentional was that, and is that your usual style, or was it something you adopted for this film?
It is my usual style. I do not use music. I do not use narration. And the reason for that is that when I go to see a film, I want to be able to think about what I've seen and to be able to come to my own conclusion about what I've seen. And I don't like to be spoken down to or told what to think. And so I wanted the stories, the very powerful stories of the mothers in the film, to stand on their own. And there is absolutely nothing I could say in a narration to try to explain or tell people what I think they should be thinking about this. And so I wanted people to hear those stories directly and then come to their own conclusion.
When did the film come out? How have you released it? And what has been the response?
The film, initially, it was difficult for me to get anyone interested in watching the film here in Japan. And I was told, one of my film colleagues said, "You've done nothing but document fear. And there is no basis for thinking that there's really anything happening or that there's any connection to radiation. There's no proof." I don't agree with that assessment. I found it very difficult to get a distributor, to get really anybody interested in the film. So I began by sending it out to film festivals abroad. It's now been shown in more than 25 film festivals around the world. I guess my idea was, if I can get the film recognized abroad, I'm going to be able to re-import it back into Japan. It's a process called reverse importing. And so I took a domestic Japanese product, put it out there in the world, and then once it started to get recognition, there was no choice but to let it come back in. And I was able to find a Japanese distributor, but it took them, I think, 6 months to get a cinema to agree to show the film. We were sitting there, like, just really puzzled, thinking, why are they not showing this film? Because, you know, there was no reason to not show the film, except they were afraid of what the effect would be. Maybe they were afraid of pressure from the government. We had two cinemas say, as individual citizens, we want to show the film, but as a corporation, we cannot show the film.
That certainly falls in alignment with the entire suppression that is going on in Japan of all honest information dealing with the nuclear accident, the impact of radiation, and what's actually happening with people's health. What is happening now with the film?
Eventually, we were able to get an independent cinema to show the film.
Where were they located?
In Tokyo. And one of the most important things, and this is something that I have said time and time again, there is no question that anyone could ask about this issue that is happening in Fukushima that cannot be answered at some point with the word money. Every single thing comes down to money. And the reason why this independent cinema was able to show this film and films like this film is because they make their own programming decisions, because they own their own building and they own the land that it's built on. They're not going to bow to any pressure from anyone. They don't have any corporate sponsors. They are truly independent. And the film originally was shown for 3 weeks in the cinema, and it was extended for another 3 weeks, for a total of 6 weeks in a cinema in Tokyo, which is really that's quite long for a documentary.
That's extraordinary for a documentary.
Yeah, and then it went on to, it's been in, I think, 9 different cities in Japan in proper cinemas, you know, as a theatrical release. And it's been shown now more than 50 times through private screenings, where a university or a private citizens group will arrange a screening. It's been shown literally all over the country.
What, if any, impact are you finding from audiences who've had a chance to view this material in Japan?
You know, this is a difficult question to answer. One of the things that I think that we really struggle with is when somebody comes to see a film like this that they know is about Fukushima, they know it's about a nuclear issue. Oftentimes, the people that come are people who are already thinking about nuclear issues. They're people who are already thinking about Fukushima. And so my hope is certainly that it will inspire them, or that it will renew those feelings within them, and that it will charge them to want to find out more and to take action. But how many people who don't already know that it's a problem are coming to see the film? And that's really what we, I think, need to be doing, is how do we reach the audience who doesn't know about what's going on? And so it's hard to gauge how much effect is the film having? How much effect is anything that we're doing having? It's really hard to gauge that.
The film seems to be a snapshot of a particular time after Fukushima, about a year to a year and a half in the aftermath of the disaster. What, if anything, has changed in the time since then that you are aware of?
Well, I keep going back to Fukushima, and I am working on a third documentary. I think the biggest change that I've noticed, and one that is really the most scary, is that I'm finding that there are even fewer people that are willing to speak. And the people that are willing to speak, so many of them are not willing to show their faces, or some of them have even said to me that they will allow me to record them, but that I must alter their voice.
So it sounds like the culture of fear has really taken hold as regards people who wish to speak honestly about their fears since Fukushima.
Absolutely. And I think that there's a fear of censorship. You know, the Japanese government has just passed this secrecy law last year, which is now going to come into effect in December. And so people are worried about, well, if I speak out, what's going to happen? The interesting thing about that is there a real possibility that the Japanese government will try to censor people? Yes, perhaps. But really, by just creating that law and creating that culture of fear, it's already having an effect, because people will start engaging in doing something called self-censorship. And so at this point, the Japanese government really doesn't have to do very much at all. They can just sit back and let people be afraid and let people self-censor. And then if people say, well, this is the climate that we're living in, the Japanese government can say, well, we didn't tell you not to publish that article. We didn't say anything. All they had to do was pass the law.
What is the future of the film, and how might people obtain a copy or at least gain access to a screening of A2BC?
This is something that we're really struggling with right now, because the mothers have asked me, please do not release the film online, and please do not release the DVD. And so my hands are really tied about what to do with it, because of course I want, and they want, as many people as possible to see their story and to see what's happening. And yet they are very afraid of retribution. And so how do we get the story out and still protect the people in the film? Because my job is not only to get the story out, but it's also to protect the people in the film. So it's not okay for us to sacrifice the people that are in the film for the greater good. And so one of my fears, actually, is that somebody's going to get a hold of the film and think, people just have got to see the film now, and put it online. I understand that way of thinking. I understand why they would think that that would be helpful, but it would not be helpful to the people that are in the film. And so I'm really between a rock and a hard place right now. I don't have an international distributor, and so I'm handling private screenings by myself. And so if somebody wants to show the film, then they contact me through the website, and then I send them a DVD, they show the DVD, and then they send the DVD back to me. It's a huge process. It takes a lot of time. I'm really trying to think about how to streamline that process and make it a bit easier.
So this is a shout out to the Nuclear Hot Seat listening audience. Certainly, if you want to arrange a screening and wish to contact Ian, what's the best way to do so?
Through my website. It's www.a2documentary.com.
Also in my shout out is, if anybody is involved with the film industry and with distribution, please make an outreach to Ian, or if you're not comfortable doing that, make an outreach to me, and I will broker the connection so that some further conversation and perhaps the necessary support will be there for getting this extremely valuable, important film out to even more people who deserve to see it.
Thank you so much.
Meanwhile, so what is your next project? Have you determined a theme, or has the theme made itself known through the material that you've already shot?
That's a, you ask such great questions. I don't sort of decide, what I'm going to film before I film. And it is like you just described, it's very organic. I go and the story reveals itself within the, in the process of filmmaking. For me, it's, some people have said to me, well, because the film A2BC documents children with thyroid cysts and nodules, and some people have said to me, well, clearly you're going to make a, your third film is going to be about children with thyroid cancer, because we do now know that there are over 100 children in Fukushima, just in the prefecture of Fukushima alone, that have been diagnosed with thyroid cancer. But that is not the main theme of the new film. I think that if we only think about thyroid cancer, we're gonna really be missing the point, because thyroid cancer is a terrible thing, and it's something that we must be very aware of and must document and get, and be aware of. But it is not the only thing that is happening to these people, and it's only just the tip of the iceberg. But as long as there are children there, I'm going to go. Someone must go. Someone must tell this story.
What you are doing is so tremendously valuable in being the eyes and the ears and the mind and the heart who is actually going there and capturing the words of those people to bring back to the rest of the world.
Thank you.
That was filmmaker Ian Thomas Ashe via Skype from Japan. We'll have a link to the trailer for his film, A2BC, up on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 178. Before we get to our next piece, I need to remind you that Nuclear Hot Seat is supported by donations. So if you can help support our ongoing work, that would be terrific. You can do so by going to nuclearhotseat.com, scroll down on the homepage, and click on the red donate button or the little thing next to it that says click here. Know that any amount helps keep this show moving forward. This next piece is part of the Nuclear Hot Seat ongoing series, Voices from Japan. Yuji Kaneko is a fine artist and photographer, as well as the husband of Nuclear Hot Seat's Voices from Japan co-producer, Beverly Findlay Kaneko. Yuji still lives in Japan and regularly goes back to Fukushima to document what is happening there. After his most recent trip to Fukushima, Yuji wrote of his impressions. Beverly translated her husband's thought for a screening in Southern California of A2BC, and she reads them here for Nuclear Hot Seat.
A2BC was mostly shot in 2012, soon after the nuclear accident at Fukushima Daiichi. The mother's worries about their children's futures is unchanged, but many things have changed in Fukushima, and not necessarily for the better. This is an update of some of the issues faced by people left behind in areas that are contaminated but not classified as evacuation or exclusion zones. As you disembark at Fukushima Station, where the bullet train stops, you will not encounter warning signs or information about radiation. There is a shop featuring local farm products. There are exhibits advertising local festivals. It is all tourism related. This may sound surprising. When you leave the station and head into town, you will not see children wearing masks like they do in A2BC. You won't see kids wearing glass badges either. If you peek into a schoolyard, you will see everyone playing outdoors. The school lunch program promotes Fukushima-sourced products. If you go to the supermarket, the seafood section is well-stocked with fish from the seas off of Tohoku. This picture is no different than what you would see in Tokyo, Osaka, Sapporo, or any other city in Japan. But is Fukushima really back to normal? If you walk beyond the main arteries of the city to the back streets, the scenery changes, and the struggle to contain the uncontainable, invisible enemy of radiation is visible to those who keep their eyes open. First, the decontamination efforts of people's homes, schools, and major city streets has progressed, but is causing new problems. Radioactive contamination does not go away. Things that are contaminated can only be washed down, allowing radionuclides to flow to the street, into the rivers and ocean, bagged up and moved elsewhere to be buried or incinerated, all of which cause a host of other problems. The industry's ultimate solution to pollution is dilution. On recent trips to Fukushima, these are some of the things that we have witnessed and photographed. There is a temporary storage facility for radioactive decontamination debris from houses and gardens and hillsides at the entrance of Shinobuyama Park, which is right near Fukushima Station. This material used to be kept on people's property, in their gardens, and right by their front doors. It was also stored on school premises. The bags were only designed to hold up for 2 or 3 years. Now the government is trucking it to temporary storage facilities like the one at Shinobuyama Park. They are rebagging the radioactive material in the open air with no protection and no radiation monitor to inform the public. The bags are torn open by heavy machinery, and the dust, assumedly radioactive, is flying. Children walk by here on their way to school. Right next door is a once popular public park. It's not so popular anymore. Even so, there are still people that jog around the perimeter of the rebagging area for their health. A monitoring post nearby, inside Shinobuyama Park, reads 0.23. This is about 5 times higher than Yokohama, which is near Tokyo. Also, remember that the government decontaminates around the monitors, and the readings are usually artificially low. There are monitoring posts at all schools in Fukushima Prefecture. The school grounds we have visited in various areas in Fukushima appear to be decontaminated fairly well. Sometimes the readings are actually lower than our home in Huntington Beach, California. School grounds may be safe, but in some cases, one step outside the gate yields high readings. This is something that one of the mothers in A2BC points out. At Watari School, near the Fukushima City Hall, the reading at waist level is about 9 times higher than in Yokohama. Readings closer to the ground are higher, about 11 times higher than Yokohama. Can children really grow up safe and healthy in this environment? Recently, we went to Fukushima to deliver the messages from our nonprofit organization's Koinobori Project. The messages we gathered from elementary, middle, and high school and university students, as well as community groups that have participated in one of our awareness programs on Fukushima. This summer, we participated in a recuperation program for Fukushima kids, which was the first place we shared the Koinobori, or CARP banner. Such programs provide a healthy environment where kids can eat safe food and play outdoors so that they can detox and de-stress. These programs were and are still used to help children affected by the Chernobyl accident. But unfortunately, in Japan, participating in these programs is very difficult. Such programs are taken as a criticism of the safety of Fukushima. Parents even have to make excuses and hide the fact that they are letting their kids participate in these programs. For reasons like this, only about 1% of families have taken advantage of such programs. One of the mothers in the group that we met this summer became very nervous when we were taking pictures and asked that we not share them on the internet. We were happy to see the kids having so much fun on their holiday from the stresses and confinement of Fukushima. But even while they were having fun, one little girl had a severe nosebleed and was crying. This was during the same time that the government made such a big deal about the Oishimbo manga referring to nosebleeds in Fukushima. Kaoru Suzuki, the director at the Tarachine Citizens Radiation Monitoring Station in Iwaki, Fukushima, and an interview on the 311 Nuclear Hot Seat Voices from Japan special, recently shared her views on the feelings of Fukushima residents with us. She said that after 3 years, the people who are worried about radiation are being pushed more and more into the margins and are feeling the psychological stress of not being able to air their concerns freely. The surrounding atmosphere is increasingly one of, everything is okay, there's nothing to worry about, which makes it more difficult for people to seek help. We also visited a school in Samegawa Village. There are only 12 kids in the school from second to sixth grade. It's a tiny school, but the kids were all very polite, happy, and full of energy. It's a little far from the nuclear power plant and in a less contaminated area, so even some recuperation programs would take short trips here. It's a place where you don't even think about radiation. 100% of the products used in the school lunch program are locally sourced. This is something that they take pride in. You want to think that it's safe. But 10 minutes by car from here, there is a legally suspect experimental incinerator that is processing radioactive debris from the local area. It's an unprecedented project by the construction ministry where high-level waste, over 8,000 becquerels per kilogram, is processed. The ministry did not get permission from one of the landowners whose property this facility was built on. There is an ongoing lawsuit alleging that the landowner's consent was falsified by the construction ministry. There was also local opposition, which was ignored. Originally, the construction ministry said that there was about 460,000 tons of local debris, contaminated plant material, sewage sludge, etc. But when they finally got the project off the ground, there was only about 40% of the material left. It is assumed that the missing debris was dealt with by local incineration, household and farm incineration, and sold to fertilizer companies. Also, the facility had a big explosion in the early days. This is the environment nearby the school that we visited. Are the children really safe? If we look at the Fukushima Prefecture mandatory school lunch program, we can see that they are promoting the use of local products. According to a flyer put out by the Forestry, Fisheries, and Agriculture Department of the prefecture, this is because sales are down elsewhere. They even provide per-student stipends for the use of local products. Is this really the right thing to do? Many countries around the world still ban the import of products from Fukushima Prefecture due to contamination. There is a list of products that the United States bans, and it is posted on the Japanese Ministry of Agriculture website. We were really happy to be able to deliver our messages of encouragement and hope to the children in Japan. But we had to promise not to talk about the nuclear power plant or radiation. Whether this was to avoid hurting the children's feelings or to help conceal inconvenient truths for the authorities or a combination of the two, it is not for us to say. But our silence will not prevent radiation from harming the health of these children. At Chernobyl, with the passing of time, children began experiencing more and more health problems. In Fukushima, there are already 104 children that have been diagnosed with thyroid cancer. The government continues to deny the connection with radiation. It is a very difficult situation. How can we help people that are not allowed to admit that they are in a situation that needs to be remedied?
That was Beverly Findlay Kaneko reading the words of her husband, Yuji Kaneko. We have some of Yuji's photos from his recent trip to Fukushima Prefecture up on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this week's episode, number 178. Many thanks to Yuji for his words, his images, and his bravery. Activist shout-outs. You know, the KPFA Project Censored interview that Kimberly Roberson of Fukushima Fallout Awareness Network and I did on Friday, November 14, seems to have knocked it out of the park, if listener response is any way to measure it. We packed as much information as we could into the hour-long show, supported by the superb questions from hosts Mickey Huff and Peter Phillips. We covered everything from soup to numbnuts. We discussed Fukushima, explained a bit about how radiation works, talked about food contamination issues, and how to help your body maintain the best possible health in an increasingly radioactive world. There's a link to Project Censored up on the Nuclear Hot Seat website for you to listen, download, and, here's the ask, pass along. The show is an overview of nuclear issues, as thorough as we could make it, with not just the bad news, but suggestions of ways to get involved and become self-empowered in both politics and health, which makes it a great piece to share. So that's what we're asking you to do. We're asking you to find three individuals who could benefit from the information and send it to them. Make it an email, a Facebook post, a Facebook message. Hey, you might even go old-fashioned and make it a letter. Woo! Do they still do that anymore? As to who you might send it to besides your Aunt Ethel, you could aim for local news reporters, editors, news directors, politicians from local to state to federal levels. And don't forget about your Public Utilities Commission. They really need to know this information. Send it to teachers, community activists, mommy groups, retirees looking for something to do, and kids who don't think they can make a difference in the world but would try if they only knew how. This program is a great way to spice up your Thanksgiving dinner conversation, so why not send the Project Censored link to your relatives as well? Just like radiation, it's the gift that keeps on giving. And next week, Kimberly and I together will share with you more information on how to help protect your health best as possible from radiation in our Fukushima world, just in time for all the major food holidays. John Stewart! Hey, Booby, your movie looks great! Mazel tov! Now, how about tackling the nuclear story next? Tell you what, let's make a deal. I'll buy a ticket to see Rosewater. You listen to Nuclear Hot Seat. Then let's meet back in the middle and discuss, preferably on your show. Final segment. Be there or be square. Here's today's final thought. The nuclear industry and its unquestioning flacks just love to diminish our awareness of the dangers of radiation by making it more complex and confusing than Hollywood's accounting system for paying royalties to writers. Radiation releases and exposures are poo-pooed as small, trace, tiny, and of course, the nuclear industry's favorite adjective, significant, as in, that's not a significant problem. Move along, there's nothing to see. Here's the deal about radiation, the Cliff Notes version, which many of you listeners may already know, but it behooves us to repeat as often as possible. And if you're not aware of this, feel free to listen twice and take notes. Every dose of radiation is significant. It accumulates throughout your life. That includes dental x-rays, MRIs, and, if you're old enough to remember them, those x-ray machines shoe stores used to use to determine your shoe size. Oh, Yeah, and we also get exposed from fallout from Fukushima. Atom bomb remains still floating through the jet stream that come down to Earth in rainouts. Leftover uranium mining tailings. And lots, lots more. Next point. There is no dose of radiation below which it is safe to be exposed. It all counts. And your tipping point into illness depends on so many factors. There's no way to predict what dose or when you get it that will push you over into a slide into progressively declining health. And here's an important one, especially when considering what's happening with the Pacific Ocean. Radiation does not dilute. When things are diluted, they become weaker and less impactful. But radioactive particles just become smaller and further apart, but they're no less deadly. The smallest possible exposure from radiation is one radioactive atom releasing one subatomic particle or ion that penetrates a single cell. It may be small, or tiny, or trace, but that doesn't mean it's not significant, because it is. So the next time you hear someone using those diminishing adjectives when talking about a radiation leak or exposure, someone is trying to misdirect your attention, to lull you into a false sense of security that it's really no big deal. Instead of falling for that trick, use that languaging as a signal that something that is significant has taken place, and push back against the semantic manipulator and the semantic manipulation until the truth is revealed. That truth may be ugly, uncomfortable, or scary, as so much about nuclear is, but at least you'll know the truth, and from there, be a conscious choice as to your further actions. They like to talk about nuclear power. This is an example of anti-nuclear empowerment. Remember, the sixth stage of grief is fighting back. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, November 18, 2014. Material for this week's program has been researched and compiled from ENENews.com, the Associated Press, Carlsbad Current, Argus, Nuclear Hot Seat. Wait a minute, we're a source? I guess we are, according to ENE News. Santa Fe, New Mexican, KOB-TV, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, Nuclear Energy Information Service, or NEIS, they're good guys in Illinois, the Press Democrat, Seattle Post-Intelligencer, University of Texas at Austin Cockrell School of Engineering, Radio EcoShock, NBC News, PBS, National Geographic, Reuters, New York Times, NHK, TEPCO, NuclearNews.net, FukuLeaks.org, EvacuateFukushima.com, CityAM.com, and the Nuclear Hot Seat Facebook community, the great and powerful, to which you are invited. Come join the party. Beverly Finlay Kaneko is the co-producer of the Voices from Japan series. Many thanks to her and her husband, Yuji, for giving us such an immediate connection to Japan. Guilty as Charged, theme music written by me, sung by Marilee Weber, who makes it sound much better than I could have by myself. Nuclear Hot Seat is syndicated by UCY.TV and is also available on airprogressive.com. Our archive is available on iTunes or on our website. You can also subscribe on iTunes under podcasts and get it every week. Our YouTube channel carries our podcast, courtesy the unflagging support of Joni Ray. Nuclear Hot Seat is the activist voice on nuclear issues. So if you have a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview, send an email to info@nuclearhotseat.com. We are copyright 2014, Libby Halevi and Hartestry Communications. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed for nonprofit groups, blogs, and websites. You have my permission to reuse this material as long as proper attribution is provided. Just give the name of the program and the website. This is Libby Halevi of Hartestry Communications, the heart of the art of communicating, reminding you that Genpatsu Hantai, Kodomo wo mamore means no nukes, protect the children. At least I hope that's what my pronunciation means. And we have all had our nuclear wake-up call, so don't go back to sleep, because we are all in the nuclear hot seat.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking.